Well, the book of Ruth, chapter 3, and we're reading from verse 9 to the end of the chapter, verse 18. Ruth, chapter 3, starting to read at verse 9 and going right through to the end of the chapter. And he said, as Boaz, "Who art thou?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, thine handmaid. Spread therefore thy skirt over thine handmaid, for thou art a near kinsman." And he said, "Blessed be thou of the Lord, my daughter, for thou hast showed more kindness in the latter end than at the beginning, inasmuch as thou followest not young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, fear not. I will do to thee all that thou requirest, for all the city of my people doth know that thou art a virtuous woman. And now it is true that I am thy near kinsman. Howbeit, there is a kinsman nearer than I. Tarry this night, and it shall be in the morning that if he will perform unto thee the part of a kinsman, well, let him do the kinsman's part. But if he will not do the part of a kinsman to thee, then will I do the part of a kinsman to thee. As the Lord liveth, lie down until the morning." And she lay at his feet until the morning, and she rose up before one could know another. And he said, "Let it not be known that a woman came into the floor." And he said, "Bring the veil that thou hast upon thee and hold it." And when she held it, he measured 6 measures of barley and laid it on her, and she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "Who art thou, my daughter?" And she told her all that the man had done to her. And she said, "These 6 measures of barley gave he me, for he said to me, 'Go not empty unto thy mother-in-law.' Then said she, 'Sit still, my daughter, until thou know how the matter will fall, for the man will not be in rest until he hath finished the thing this day.'" And amen. God's immigration policy. I struggled about the title whenever I was thinking of this series, because immigration has a way of raising the heckles in many people, and I don't confess to have all the answers. It certainly seems to hurt UK jobs, and yet at the same time many sectors, for example the National Health Service, need foreign workers, and they struggle without them, and there has been a drop in the numbers coming over. There is an increase in the danger of terrorism. It destroys the British way of life and our value system. It adds to the crime figures, they say, and is a drain on our social services budget. And so the arguments continue. Worldwide, there is an estimated 191 million immigrants. And the last 50 years has seen immigration double in size in the West. Almost 50% of that number, 95 million immigrants, are women. And yet, while closing our borders, as some would want us to do, our people want to be free to be able to move to Australia or Canada or Africa or United States or France or wherever. And so the debate goes back and forward. I am looking just at one immigrant, a widow girl. She has escaped Moab, present-day Jordan, and she has moved with her family, at least some of them, to Israel. The date that we are thinking about is probably or possibly as early as 1300 BC. Some would give it a slightly later date. But she escapes Moab and she arrives in Israel. And we have noticed so far that chapter 1, a chapter of sorrow, Ruth is weeping. Chapter 2, a chapter of service, Ruth is working in the harvest field, and she is one to hap on the field of Boaz. And in chapter 3, where we are, we find that she is submission. She is waiting. She is surrendering. And while she waits and while she submits, she is teaching us how to approach our heavenly Boaz, How should we approach church? How should we approach our quiet times? How should we approach our heavenly Savior? And so far in this chapter, we have seen that you come with the right motive to be near Him, to know Him, not just to get from Him. So often we go to people because of what we can get off them, but no, the right approach is to come to get to know Him, to be near to Him, our heavenly Boaz. To come to the right person. Because we find that in Ruth's case there was other interests, but she had only eyes for Boaz. And so it should be, that we have only eyes for our Savior. She came with the right preparation. We looked at that. She washed, she anointed, she adorned. And we looked at the dress and the code of dress as we come to our heavenly Boaz. Having the old, dead trappings removed. And adorned with the garments of grace. And then we come with the right submission. We saw that she comes to His feet. And she wants to be under His wing. She had been under the wing of the Lord, of course. Under whose wings art thou come to trust. She's trusting in the covenant-keeping God. But she says, I want to be also under your covenant. And under your promise also. The right submission. And then last time we saw that she came with the right hearing. And we saw in verses 10 to 13 that He accepts her, He assures her, and He assists her. And of course that study is available. It's interesting that in verse 11, Boaz calls Ruth a virtuous woman. In fact, all the city of my people doth know that you're a virtuous woman. Now remember, Ruth has just recently converted from paganism. And the worship and the style of worship she was used to was certainly not virtuous. It was the opposite end of the spectrum. But such was her metaphoric conversion, her transformation, that Boaz says, all the city know that you are a virtuous woman. Solomon knew a lot about women. We are told in 1 Kings 11, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. That's some mothers-in-law, huh? That's a handful. He had 700 wives, 300 concubines. And he said, who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies. So as he looked at his 700 wives, as he looked at his 300 concubines, as he assessed the character of these women that shared his life, he said, who can find a virtuous woman? And when you find one, hold on to her, because her price is far above rubies. Solomon is saying that a good, godly woman is very scarce. And newly converted Ruth is one of them. Amazing, isn't it? From her background. I suppose we need to ask the question then, what constitutes a virtuous woman? I'm getting into difficult territory tonight. I could be lynched before I get home. Huh? Well, the root word gives us two aspects. Kail in the Hebrew. Kail is a very interesting word. It speaks of force or strength. That's the root word of that word, virtuous. And so we find that a virtuous woman is a woman of spiritual force or spiritual impact. It's a woman with spiritual character, spiritual resolve, spiritual backbone, spiritual wisdom and impact as she lives out her life. And people like that are hard to find. It also carries with it the idea of a fruitful woman. And in Old Testament times, that also was having offspring. It was seen as being virtuous to have children to carry on the family line. But we can apply it as having a woman with spiritual fruit. And of course, exhibiting the fruit of the Spirit that we find in Galatians chapter 5, love, joy, peace, patience, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, self-control. I think maybe that's the nine segments. And such a woman is rare. A woman that has spiritual backbone, spiritual force, and also these fruits of the Spirit. Now, before the men get too arrogant or big-headed, if godly women are rare, I would argue that it's 10 times harder to find a virtuous man. I tell you why, because men so often react emotionally. They are creatures that are affected a lot by what they see, what they hear. That's why pornography is such a problem for men. They are affected more by what they see. And so, if a virtuous woman is rare, I would argue that virtuous men are even rarer. In the city of Bethlehem, the foreign Moabitish damsel, this immigrant from across the border, had made a godly impact in a relatively short space of time. And it was such that Boaz could say, all the city know that you're a woman of spiritual force, you're a woman of spiritual fruit, you're a virtuous woman. What a goal to have. But then in verse 12, Boaz lands the bombshell. Yes, he says, I am a near kinsman. I have the money, I have the ability, I have the desire to redeem you. Yes, under the law we could marry and raise a family in the name of your deceased husband, Mahlon, and so his name is honored and his legacy is maintained. But, those buts of the Bible, but there is a nearer kinsman than I. And I'm sure Ruth's heart sank. I'm sure she thought that all her dreams were disappearing. It would seem as if Boaz has already thought about this matter. He's already weighed up the legal requirement and the legal implications. And he says, no, there's a snag, there's a problem, there's a nearer kinsman. Could I pause there just to say that our God is a God of detail. I worry nowadays that so many come and they want to read the Bible and dismiss all the detail. As if, well, that's not important. God put it in there for a purpose. God put the fine details in to teach his lessons. My father-in-law was a gentleman, Stanley. We miss him. I never had a fallout with Stanley in my life, even though I took his daughter. But it came close on one occasion. I decided in my house in Belfast to put up a greenhouse. And Stanley, being Stanley, said, no problem, I'll come and help you. And I thought, that's great. We'll get it up twice as quick. What I didn't realize was Stanley was a different personality than me. You see, whenever I build something, I get the instruction book out and you start at number one and you do what it tells you at number one, then you go to number two, then number three. Before you even you start that, you make sure all the parts are as they said that should come in the packet. But that wasn't Stanley. No, Stanley didn't even look at the instruction manual. He just looked and said, well, that obviously goes there. That obviously goes there. That goes there, and sure, we'll put it together. He got it up quick, but we had parts left over. And to the day I left the house, I wondered, where on earth were those pieces meant to be? You see, Stanley didn't worry about the detail. He knew the shape that it was meant to be. He could see it in his mind. And he just forgot about the instructions. He was putting it up. Oh, and it's not the way I did things. And I was getting more and more hot under the collar. And I had to bite my lip. Our God is a God of detail. He's given us the instruction manual. He expects us to follow it so that all will be well. And things that people quickly dismiss and say, oh, that's old-fashioned, and that's out of date, and that's not applicable, and that's not relevant. God put it in there in His inspired Word for a divine purpose. And so for me, I'll follow the manual. And I'll follow the instructions as we have them. Isn't it amazing in our story of Ruth how often when we think a problem is sorted and a difficulty is being resolved, a new problem arises, it stops us getting overconfident and blasé, I suppose. I'm reminded of Paul's writing to the church at Philippi, Philippians 1 and 6. It says, being confident of this very thing, that he which hath begun a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. That's what Boaz was saying to Ruth. Just you be content now. I'll deal with the matter. You lie down until the morning. I'm working this out. I'll attend to the matter. And it reminds me of my heavenly Boaz. How that he is working out his purposes in my life. And I can rest. I can be confident in him. That the thing that he has started, that good work that he is performing, he will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. The Lord of the harvest is on the case. And he will perfect and complete all that he has planned in you and for you. In verse 13, he said to her, tarry this night. That word tarry is very interesting. It means to be calm and have serenity. What a word. Be calm, Ruth. Be contented. Have a serenity. I have 5 grandchildren, and I am running out of serenity and calm. I have discovered that the words, Dad, take her for a few seconds, never actually means a few seconds. They're a joy, of course. A joy. But you need to have patience. And you need to have that serenity. Whenever they're standing on your last nerve. A lady said to me recently when I was out visiting, she said, Pastor, I wish I was as thin as my patience. I think maybe we all would wish that. Boaz said, tarry this night. Be serene. Be calm. I shall attend to the matter. Notice it says in verse 13, as the Lord liveth, lie down until the morning. Isn't that a lovely phrase? As the Lord liveth, lie down until the morning. You see, when we know that the Lord liveth, then we can rest there. As long as we appreciate that the Lord is alive, then we can rest contentedly. But the opposite is also true. If we doubt whether the Lord is alive, if we doubt whether the Lord is in control, then we will be restless and anxious and fearful. But when we know He's alive, we can rest. I think it was Charles Wesley wrote in 1742 that hymn, Father of Jesus Christ, my Lord. One of the verses says, faith, mighty faith, the promise sees and looks to that alone. Laughs at impossibilities and cries, it shall be done. We can rest that he will do the work. Let's move on. The right motive, the right person, the right preparation, the right submission, the right hearing. Notice the right spirit. Verse 14, and she lay at his feet until the morning, and she rose up before one could know another. And he said, let it not be known that a woman came into the floor. Also he said, bring the veil that thou hast upon thee and hold it. And she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and so on. Ruth lay at Boaz's feet until the morning, and she left before anybody would know that she had been there. It would never do, you see, to have gossiping tongues and wild speculations before the legal matters were attended to. This is not evidence of misdemeanor. It's not evidence of immorality or embarrassment. Rather, an indication that they wanted things done properly in the right way and the right order. So she slipped out before anyone would know The time would come when they would know. The time would come whenever it would be revealed. And Boaz and her heart feelings would be obvious to all. But that was for later. Now it was a legal matter. And so she slipped out. One of the problems with our media technology that we have these days is, and social networking, is the world wants instant information. They want instant news. There's nothing like that juicy bit of gossip. And whether it's the old way of ringing people or whether it's through the social media, doesn't really matter very much. I had the smile. I've been at weddings when it has been announced from the front that the guests are not to post photographs of the wedding on social media because the bride and groom want their family and their friends to see first, and they want to be the ones to spread the news and to send out the photographs. And so it's been announced, please do not put photographs of the wedding on social media. And Ruth is making sure that things are done decently and in order. And so she slips home before this daylight. She had the right spirit. Before she left, Boaz asked her to hold out her shawl and put 10 days' supply of food into it. Can I pause again and remind you that our God is a lavish and generous God? As I sat in the study today, I had to amend my PowerPoint because I wanted to put in this psalm. And I was thinking about it much today. Psalm 36. And it speaks about how lavish our God is. God's love, thy mercy, O Lord, is in the heavens. God's love is infinite. It reaches right as far as you can imagine. That's God's mercy. That's God's love. Notice again, thy faithfulness reaches unto the clouds. God's faithfulness is immense. You cannot measure it. It is beyond anything that we can imagine. God's purpose, his righteousness, his way of doing things is like the great mountains. It's inexhaustible. That's God's purpose, God's righteousness. God's justice are a great deep. His justice is unmeasurable. His kindness, how excellent is thy loving kindness. His kindness is incredible. And so in that psalm, time and time again, we see the lavishness of God, the greatness of God. And we could think of many verses, couldn't we? Psalm 23, he makes our cup to overflow. We can think of Ephesians 3 that we'll get to on Sunday mornings. Our God is able to do more abundantly than all that we ask or even think. He's a lavish God. We can think of how in Psalm 103, our God is compassionate, slow to anger, plenteous in mercy. And there's time and time again the greatness and the abundance of God. He's not just our shepherd. He's our great shepherd. He strengthens our faith. He satisfies our soul. He brightens our hope. And Ruth had been living on leftovers that had been dropped during the harvest. But now the Lord of the harvest is providing and caring for her. Notice verse 17. She said, these 6 measures of barley gave he me, for he said to me, go not empty unto thy mother-in-law. Isn't that interesting? I think whenever Boaz said that, he had a smile on his face. Why? Because when Naomi came home to Bethlehem, one of the things that she said was that I'm coming back to Bethlehem empty. I went out full, but I'm back empty. And Boaz has said, no, no. You bring this home to your mother-in-law because with God you're never empty. There's always an abundant supply. And I think Boaz has given her a wee reminder of what she said when she arrived back. And so he asks Ruth to hold out her shawl and he puts that 10 days' supply of food into it. And Ruth travels then back that short distance to Bethlehem with that shawl full of 6 measures of barley to share with Naomi. Let me pause there again and ask the question, do you share what the Lord gives you with others? That's a big question, isn't it? God loves a cheerful giver, we read in 2 Corinthians 9 and 7. And God gives to us, not that we might own our wealth, but that we might be stewards of it. And what I have in my bank account, what I have as a family, one day I will give an account for what I have. It's not mine. And that can lead to all kinds of questions. And someone asked me recently, do I leave money in my will to unsaved children? If this is the Lord's money and I'm just a steward, what a big issue, isn't it? What if they squander it? And yet if they don't give and you just give to the Christians in the family, then you'll have children making professions that are not real at all, just to make sure they're in the will. Stewardship is a big deal. Let me put it into perspective. The American Evangelistic or Evangelical Church is the wealthiest community of Christians since the birth of the church in the day of Pentecost. So 2,000 years. The believers in America, evangelical believers in America, are the wealthiest community of Christians. It is estimated that the total income of American evangelicals is $5.2 trillion US. Now, I did a wee bit of calculating. It would take just a little over 1% of the income of American Christians to lift the poorest 1 billion people in the world out of extreme poverty. Just over 1% of their income. American evangelicals, who make up about 5% of the church worldwide, control about 50% of the global Christians' wealth. And we in the UK are not far behind. We have a church globally that is too comfortable, that is insulated from the pain of the rest of the world. We can be empty of compassion and devoid of deeds. And the generation to come, as they write of this generation, will they write that we stood by and watched while 50 million people died of AIDS and never did a thing? We stood and sang our hymns while 40 million children were orphaned. Will they write in their essays that the Christians who lived in the 20th and 21st century lived in luxury and self-indulgence while millions died through lack of food and lack of water? Will school children read and discuss of churches building multi-million pound sanctuaries, but lacked in the desire to build schools and hospitals and clinics? Will the church be like Boaz? Generous and giving? Will our kids see authentic Christians rise up courageously and respond to the tide of human suffering? Will they see us run to the front lines to comfort the afflicted and douse the flames of hatred? Will they say that the start of the 21st century was the church's finest hour? Or will they say it was our worst? Boaz is a giver. Boaz is generous. And he says, hold out your shawl and I'll give you 10 days worth of food just to take home to your mother-in-law and remind us how lavish our God is. Of course, it's not just money. It's giving our time and giving our talent and giving our skills and giving our homes. I have a friend. I'll call him Craig. It's not his real name. But Craig always has a wee thought. Every time you meet him, he shares a wee thought. And these wee thoughts have been going on for years. And people tried to avoid Craig because they were embarrassed by his wee thoughts. He said to me one day, he says, "Lawrence, I know people don't like my wee thoughts. I know they find them embarrassing." He said, "But I believe if God blesses me from His Word, I will get nothing more until I pass on what He has given to me." God does not give us blessings. He loans them to us. And we only get the full blessings of them when we pass them on. In verse 16, Naomi sees her daughter-in-law arrive home with 10 days' supply of food, and she asks, "Who art thou, my daughter?" Is she doting? Is she bad eyesight? Why would she say that? "Who art thou, my daughter?" No, she wasn't doting. No, she wasn't confused. She wasn't ill. No, what she was saying was, "Are you Mrs. Boaz yet? What is your marital status? Has it changed? Has he proposed marriage yet?" And Ruth told her all that Boaz had done. The right motive, the right person, the right preparation, the right submission, the right hearing, the right spirit. Notice finally, the right patience. Look at verse 18. "Then said she, 'Sit still, my daughter, until thou know how the matter will fall, for that man will not be in rest until he hath finished the thing this day.'" For me, this is one of the greatest Bible verses in all of Scripture. In chapter 1, Naomi gave Ruth bad advice. "Go back to your mom, go back to your dad, go back to your old ways, go back to Moab, go back with your sister-in-law." But now in chapter 3 and 18, Naomi gives Ruth very good advice. "Sit still, my daughter, until I know how the matter will fall." You could bring three verses together. Ruth 3 and 18, "Sit still and wait." And then in Exodus 14, do you remember when the children of Israel left Egypt and they came to the Red Sea and there was the mountains on the side and the Egyptian army was hounding them from the back and they started to complain. They said, "Why did you get us to leave Egypt to die in the wilderness?" And Moses said, "Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. Stand still and see. Just you watch what God will do." And then in Psalm 46, that psalm where David is writing to encourage us to hope and trust in the Lord, and he says, "Be still and know that I am God." Lovely wee train of thought. Sit still and wait. Stand still and see. Be still and know. That's a sermon for somebody. If James McKeown, one of our full-time workers, was here, with his expertise in Hebrew, he would say that the word "still" means take your hands off. Hands off. And that's interesting. Take your hands off and wait. Take your hands off and watch. Take your hands off and know. You see, we're not good at taking our hands off. We love the medal. We love to manipulate and control and engineer and maneuver. We play God in people's lives. We mean well. We genuinely believe we're helping. And of course, there is a place for advice and exhortation and encouragement. But once we start to meddle, God says, Be still. Take your hands off. Naomi said, sit still and wait. Take your hands off. Ruth, don't meddle. This man will attend to the matter. We have got to trust him. And he will attend to the matter in his time. And there is a point in the things of God, whenever we leave a problem with the Lord and we lay it before the throne, maybe with tears in our eyes, there comes a point when we have to wait and see. We have to let it go and let him work out his purposes. Beloved, soon our heavenly Boaz is going to claim his bride. He'll come to call his church. And meanwhile, we sit still. We know that he will come at the perfect time, and we can say with Naomi, for he will not be at rest until he has finished this thing. And so whenever it comes to the return of the Lord and things concerning prophecy, we have to wait and see. And while we wait, we work in the harvest field, gathering in the harvest from the seed that is sown. You know, it's a lovely study to look at the hand of God. We have to have our hands off, but he has his hands on. You know, when it came to the work of creation, God didn't leave anything undone. It was a finished work. It was a completed work. He finished it completely. Whenever it came to his hands on the work of redemption, he could say, it is finished. A completed work. Finished. Absolutely. The last moment on the cross, whenever it came to fulfilling our salvation, he did it perfectly. He completed the work. And he is completing the work in us and through us. And so the Lord will not leave anything undone when it comes to our glorification. And whenever we get to heaven, it will be a perfect, completed, finished work. The church father, John Chrysostom, he was the Archbishop of Constantinople way back in 407. But he said this on one occasion. It's worth repeating. If one man should suffer all the sorrows of all the saints in all the world, yet they are not worth one hour's glory in heaven. Isn't that amazing? Let me say it again. If one man should suffer all the sorrows of all the saints in all the world, yet they are not worth one hour's glory in heaven. He will finish the work. There will be no regrets in heaven. There will be no remorseful tears, no second thoughts, no lost causes. He will finish the work. Heaven is a day without a cloud to darken it and without a night to end it. He will finish the work. Next time we are going to start into chapter 4. We're following this theme the whole way through. Sorrow, chapter 1, Ruth is weeping. Service, chapter 2, Ruth is working. Submission, chapter 3, Ruth is waiting. Chapter 4, satisfaction, Ruth is wedding. And we're going to see that a book that started with 3 funerals ends up in a wedding. A book that started with bitterness and sadness ends up with joy and blessing. A book that started with death will end up with the birth of a baby who became the ancestor of David and ultimately an ancestor of the Messiah. God is working out his perfect plan.